couple of weeks ago and gave a tutorial on charged surfaces. So even though you weren't all here, many of you were, and I'm going to assume you know everything that I said then. So that's why it's going to be very short. Did Eichel leave yet? Oh, Eichel's still hiding there. Okay. We know that heterogeneously charged surfaces occur, are quite common in biology. All globular, very many globular proteins have patches of anionic and cationic patches, which we know are very important for recognition and things like that. And we heard yesterday from Jason here that you could see these things in his AFM experiments. Okay. What I'm going to talk about today is a special case that's very similar in flavor to what you heard yesterday. And I'd say the interesting situation are the experiments, not so much how we think about them, but I'll tell you a little bit about it. The experiments are mostly carried out by Emily Meyer, whose name is there, who's just finishing her thesis in the Israel Ashvili group a few hundred meters from my office. And what little calculations there are, and actually I won't show you very many, are done by Alexei Nadyanov, who's a graduate student in physics. Well, actually, both Emily and Alexei are physics graduate students. Some of the ideas of the modeling are done with Sam Safran, who keeps beating on us to do things the way he wants them done. Okay. And some of you know Sam. Okay. I'm not talking about general case of heterogeneously charged surface. I'm talking about a specific case, so I want to tell you about the experiments. Okay, and the motivation for the experiments are the hydrophobic interaction. Now, I'll start off by telling you that this talk has nothing to do with the hydrophobic interaction in the context of why oil and water don't mix. But the idea for the people who were doing these kind of experiments, so go back a long time, the other people thought it had something to do with it. So they talk about it, they call it the hydrophobic. These are studies of the hydrophobic interaction, but those are just a bad usage of language, in my opinion. Okay. But it's so the experiment that these guys did, so this is experiments that were not, this is the modern version, but there were a lot of experiments were done a long time ago by a group in Minnesota, and I'm trying to remember whose name it was. Not important. Okay. But it's the same kind of experiment as this. Not by Matt, but Venestrom was part of it, but of course Venestrom is a theorist. Venestrom and I forgot who. Okay. So I could find the reference if you need it. But the experiment is this using the surface force apparatus, which is the apparatus that Israel Ashvili and others use, like Matt Tyrell, to measure forces between surface down to very small distances. This is kind of a picture, and I'll show you maybe a different kind of a picture of the apparatus. But what the idea is to measure, what they wanted to do was to measure the forces between hydrophobic surfaces. Now, the only surface they could use for technical reasons is mica. And mica is very hydrophilic. In fact, it has, and this is an important number, one OH group per square nanometer. Okay. So it's completely hydrophilic, and mica is a clay, you know that. But that's the only surface they could use. So the idea that it goes back to all of these experiments, a whole series of them that are going back 20 years or so, is to make the surface hydrophobic. And the way they do it is just in a sort of obvious thing. They do a Langmuir deposition using cationic surfactants. So they just take, this is this green thing is their mica. They dip their mica into a water or something. They pull it out, and presumably this is what happens. That all of these OH groups or most of them are passivated by cationic surfactants, and what you have left is this functionalized mica that has these tails sticking out, which are hydrophobic. So, and then you take that mica and put it into water, and now you have two hydrophobic surfaces.
What
color is
the air?
Pardon me?
The white color.
The white is just air.
Okay.
They just pull it, and then they go to another bucket of water, and they put their surface in, and they do their experiment. And their experiment is like this. They take two surfaces like this, push it together, and they measure the force. And they measure the force with springs. There's nothing fancy about the experiment in principle. So this is the same kind of experiment that the Minnesota group did and other groups did many years ago. And all these experiments find the same thing when they measure the force, that indeed there's a strong, attractive interaction. I'll show you some forces, some force curves. And the range of this interaction extends some tens of nanometers. So you have a rather long-range attractive force, and all these guys say, voila, that's the hydrophobic interaction. Now all we have to do is understand it. Okay. So what's different? This is the same experiment that Emily Meyer did. Whatever she did, it was like maybe 2 years ago now. But and she measures the same kind of forces that Venezuela. They measure the forces nowadays a little bit better, because they could use video microscopy and they could get the shorter distances than people could 10 or 15 years ago, but it's basically the same. But the difference with what people did 10 years ago is that, which they didn't do then, was to look at the surfaces. Okay, so that tells you what's going on. So this is what the surfaces look like. Now, there's a lot of pictures like this. This happens to be ones from Munich. This is to make Roland happy, his buddies, LMU. Down the road, but their surfaces always look like this. Those of you look at PhysRev letters, there was a letter maybe a few weeks ago by Jacob Klein, where they did similar experiments at Oxford, and he had also pictures like this, and I'll show you others. So the pictures of these mica surfaces are not a monolayer of mica. And you can tell by the scale here, what these things are patches of bilayer, and the black stuff is bare mica. So you don't have, this is what's nominally a monolayer of mica, a monolayer of surfactant, and it's not at all like that.
This is before they put them together.
This is before they put them together. This is underwater, but before they put them together. That's correct.
Do they look also after they put them together?
Yes, and then they pull them apart, and they look, and they look similar. I mean, they don't...
It doesn't all transfer to another surface.
No.
This is roughly.
Roughly that.
Phil, are you saying it's 50% white and 50% gray?
Yeah, it's approximately. In fact, in the ones that Emily analyzed, which is I think not this one, but the ones from, there was some from Santa Barbara. Maybe I'll show you the next curve. They were something like 60-40. These are the similar ones from Hodgman's lab, but they were essentially 50-50. You could say the difference between 50-50 and 60-40 was because there was some expansion or contraction of the layers. But it was, to my mind, it was 50-50. But Jacob Jankala makes a big deal that it's not. Okay, so in my mind, it's 50-50.
So can you rule out that some stuff calls up as micelles? These calls once you form.
No, that's difficult to do. But the CFC for this for these surfactants, I forgot which one they are, very, very low.
Okay.
Is that correct?
And I think it was the other way around. There was more surfactant. board double layer, huh?
Is there a characteristic length scale in these patches?
Yeah, so the carrot, well, you can see, they're tens of nanometers. But there's the, but there's a big distribution, very broad distribution.
Why do you want it to be 50-50? Because you're going to take half monolayer and then put it on top of the other half?
Paco, I didn't hear you.
Why do you want it to be 50-50?
Oh, I don't, oh.
Because if you're going to take half of it and pull it off.
Yeah, okay. So the reason why, yeah. So the reason is why you want it, you think that it's 50-50, is that presumably you start out with a model layer, you take it out, there's no, you put it in water, there's no excess, there's no reservoir surfactants, and what they're going to do is they just flip over. So half of them flip. I mean, that's crudely what you think happens.
And really nobody had any idea it was doing this before?
Not until the last, whatever it is, 2 years that people have been doing this. That's right. Okay, so... So this is not a picture of their apparatus, but it's a crude model. Just two surfaces with a spring, okay? That's it. This is a typical curve that Emily measures. They look like this. The open circles are for two, the both surfaces, when they measure the forces, are nominally identical. This is so force versus distance in angstroms. So you see the range is tens of nanometers. It's attractive. You're not used to looking at these pictures. This is the force normalized for the, with the rate. Well, you don't want to know. You don't want to know the units. But the point is that these are very strong attractive forces. These are not weak. These are strong. Okay, and I'll give you an idea of the. Of the magnitude later. Okay. Strong but finite range, 20 nanometers. They're much stronger than van der Waals or anything like that. And this is consistent with the earlier measurements by the Minnesota group. I mean, the only difference is that the Minnesota group guys went to about here, they didn't have these points. Okay, the black circles, which is a stronger attraction, occurs when you have one of these functionalized surfaces against a bare mica.
Okay.
Okay. And that's important in their in the experimental group's mind, and I'll tell you why shortly. So that's a good thing to notice is that the black points where you have bare mica. Again, the functionalized mica is a much stronger, at finite distances, a much stronger attraction. So I say that this is consistent with 1 over R at short distances. It is, but that's not the way, again, Emily Meyer did the experiments. She hates that when I say that. And she says, she does the best. Best fit she could do is some kind of combination of multiple exponentials and stuff, but you can't tell the difference. Okay.
With the eyeball model.
Okay, so what's going on? Why the forces are attractive is absolutely no mystery once you see the patches. If you see a patchy surface, I mean, you could look at this Yankala cartoon. You have patches of bilayer, which are essentially positively charged. They're cationic because there are two, roughly, if there were no expansion, two lipids per OH minus. So these are doubly positive. These are negative, and you have positive charges against negative charges. They correlate and attract. This is what we long time called the Bloomfield-Rosina mechanism. This is the same mechanism, roughly speaking, of why DNA sticks together in the presence of multivalent cations. It just form these patches. It's a different length scale. Here the patches are on the scale of nanometers, okay, as you saw, tens of nanometers. But so why there's an attractive force is no mystery. And in fact, the numbers are right, because if it's electrostatics, you just put in screen-Coulomb interaction or whatever you want, and you calculate the force, just a freshman physics calculation to do that, and the numbers, and the surface force measurements measure very accurately the adhesive energy, the energy in contact, so they let them jump into contact and pull them apart, they can tell that, and the numbers are right on. Okay. So it seems to me there's absolutely no doubt that the origin of the attractive force is purely electrostatics. Once you see the pictures. I mean, if you didn't see the pictures and you thought it was pure surface, then you wouldn't know. But once you see the pictures, there's no doubt. So it took me about a month of yelling at Jan, at Jacob Israel Asfili to convince him that that was the case. But I think he believes that now. But the so that's not the puzzle. Okay. The forces are not a puzzle. The puzzle, in my mind, is why you have the patches. Okay. And why you have the patches with a length scale that's tens of nanometers.
Can a patch move along?
Good question. So so from the AFM, the ones that I know about, the ones at LMU and the ones at Santa Barbara, they were not sophisticated enough to tell. They couldn't tell. It was too tricky. You know, you never know whether you're pushing them with the. But Jacob claims there's no doubt that the patches are mobile, and that's important. And the reason for that is that other experiments. I think I have that here. Well, before I get to that, the fact that these things fold over and form double layers. It's no mystery. It's just that the oil water interfacial tension is so huge that all they lose by flipping over is a little screen Coulomb interaction. You put in the numbers, and there's no doubt. So there was never a chance that these things, when you absorb them, would have the hair sticking into the water as a model layer. To do that, you better do something stronger and covalently bind them or something to the surface, and people, of course, are trying to do that, but it's not trivial. I mean, it's just chemistry, but it's not trivial chemistry. Okay, so now the question, I think maybe the next picture. Okay, so this is what happens here. This is the Jacob's argument why he claims that they're mobile. So let's look at this experiment of this asymmetric system, the one with the dark points, the bare mica, this is the bare mica against these curves. The first thing that I didn't insist upon, but I have to tell you, is that these surfaces, as is shown here, are curved. They glue the mica to essentially a glass or a quartz cylinder with a large radius of curvature around a centimeter or so. So that's why these things here are curved. And if they were mobile, then clearly this negative surface would attract these positive patches. So you'd be more patches would move in, and you get a much stronger attraction than you would have before. And that's consistent with the experiments. But then they come together like this. And now it looks the same as it would have been if I brought two patchy surfaces together. And when they rip them apart and put it back together, it's just like the other surfaces. So this makes them think that these things are really mobile and moving in. And that's the only argument that I know of for experimental argument for mobility.
For the symmetric case, do they ever get that it sticks? Because if it's mobile, you could imagine that when you bring them together and hold them there for a while, it all heals, and you simply get a bilayer.
You do. That's what they think. You get a bilayer.
I mean,
but once you rip it apart, it seems to go back to these holes. That's a good point. Yeah.
We've actually seen them mobile, like the surfaces with AFM. So you know, if you have two patches go together, one patch brings them to the surface.
So you've seen them.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're mobile.
But they couldn't do that. They couldn't see that. But and that's crucial, of course, to these arguments. Okay, so the question is, what why are the patches of finite size? One possibility, of course, is that it's all non-equilibrium stuff. Okay? But it doesn't look like that because it looks like the patches of mobile. So the other way of thinking about it is one of Marcus's favorite thing is the Rayleigh instability. So let me remind you, Marcus, and some of you guys know what the Rayleigh instability is, but some don't, and there's a lot of Rayleigh instability, so I'll remind you what it is. Nothing to do with this problem. I just squeeze perfume out of a bottle with an atomizer, you know, and you get the spray. And that works the following way. You squeeze out a droplet, but because you're pushing the fluid through a wall, you pick up some charge by static electricity. So you have a charged droplet. So let's say Z charges on a droplet of liquid, let's say of water. The droplet explodes because there's a huge Coulomb energy, is the biggest energy that we deal with in condensed matter physics. And if you have a charge, it's a huge energy, and it wants to drop the droplet to explode, to lower the Coulomb energy of the droplet. And what's holding the droplet together is surface tension. So you just do that balance, and you can find out the size of the final droplets. And I just do the algebra on the next slide. This is from many centuries ago, from Rayleigh. And you could do the whole calculation. You just assume that this big drop of radius r breaks up into n little drops of radius a. Assume it's all homogeneous, that each droplet, little droplet, has the charge, one-nth of the charge. Just do this easiest. And then you just write down the energy. The energy is two terms, electrostatic energy, that's Coulomb energy, Z over n charges, epsilon is a dielectric constant or whatever it's in, it doesn't make any difference, multiplied by the number of droplets. So that's the Coulomb energy of all these droplets. And then this is the surface tension. Gamma is the surface tension of each droplet, the air surface area times the number of droplets. But you have a constraint that water is incompressible at this level, so that there's a relationship between the radius of the original droplet and just the volume constraint and the number of droplets. Okay, so you just minimize this. This is, you know, again, a freshman calculation, and you find that the optimum size, of course, scales with r, since that's the original length, involves these parameters. If you just put in numbers for a typical charged droplet, it's something like that, just putting in the typical numbers. So that's the Rayleigh instability in three dimensions, and of course, you could see what we're arguing is that this finite droplets could be, the finite patches size could be related to the same thing on surfaces. Okay, so let me give you the argument. So instead of, you know, as I told you last time, I'm a physicist, so I don't do the real problem. I do the simplest problem I can. You didn't like that. I do the so instead of doing a patchy surface and trying to do all this thing, this is good enough. I'll do the easiest thing I can. I'm going to assume a striped surface. And I'm going to assume 50-50. That's what I like. So equal, some regions of the surface are positive, some are negative. And I'm going to calculate the Coulomb energy of that. Of course, this is in contact with this three-dimensional bucket of water. And then I have a certain line tension associated with these lines. Instead of doing it like this, just because physicists like to work in momentum space, I'm going to assume this is really not a sharp thing, but a modulated, that the charge density goes as a cosine of qx, okay, with some wavelength. At the end, the wavelength, or the wave vector, is the size of the patch. I'm going to do it. And don't worry that I'm doing it in two dimensions instead of doing it in three dimensions. Maybe I'm better doing a checkerboard, but then the algebra gets more complicated and nothing changes. I guarantee that we've done that. Okay. So this is, I want to look at that surface. Now the nice thing about that, okay, let me define some terms. So I'm going to do it, so I'm going to, what time is it? Okay. So I'm just going to define terms that I use. I like to measure electrostatic potentials in dimensionless units. So if phi is a real electrostatic potential, I multiply by the charge of the electron defined by T. That way it's dimensionless. There's this famous Bjerrum length, again, which is the distance between which two charges interact with an energy kT, Coulomb law. In water, that's about roughly a half a nanometer. So that's an important length scale. The other length scale that's important for charged surfaces, you've heard about it before, the Gouy-Chapman length. And that's defined this way. And remember, sigma naught is the maximum in my charge density, and L is the Bjerrum length. Just give you a number, I didn't tell you the number. If sigma naught was one, like mica, one charge per square nanometer, then lambda is a few angstroms. So it's a fraction of a nanometer. It's a small length. Okay. And I told you that last time. Turns out if I have that striped surface, and if I don't have any salt in solution, I don't need any salt because the surface itself is neutral. Then that's maybe a junior level physics course problem you could just solve, and that's the exact potential of that problem. That's obviously satisfied as Laplace's equation, right? And it satisfies the boundary condition. So this is the exact solution of the potential in the volume for a striped surface with the absence of any ions in the solution. Just a nothing problem. I never knew that problem was exactly soluble until I thought about it. So write it down. I'm sure it's in all the textbooks. But I don't remember. But I taught E&M, I never taught that one. But it's a simple problem. And this is the potential in my units. That's why I have this lambda. The lambda just appear here, that's just the amplitude, and that's it. So first thing you notice looking at this is that the electric field, of course, falls off exponentially at long distances. The length scale is given by the periodicity of the structure. It's the only length in the problem. And that's it. Okay, nothing special. If I take two of those surfaces and push them together, it depends whether the two surfaces have their pink things overlapping or not. It depends on the phase. If they're in phase, they're repulsive, because I have positive against positive. If they're out of phase, which of course is what happens in nature, it's attractive. It's short range. See, the range is given by the size of the patch, just like the experiments. You already see the confidence. Remember, the range of the interaction was the size of the patch. So it's the same kind of thing. And it's very strong. It's the Coulomb, just the force between two kind of capacitors. It's a very strong electrostatics. Okay, so that's sort of undergraduate physics problem. That's the force between two surfaces. If I go back to one surface, that's the potential. I could calculate the energy, the electrostatic energy of that. That's just E squared over 8 pi integrated over the volume of the thing. I'll give you the answer. The electrostatic energy in that is just this. It has the right units. This is the energy per unit area of that surface. Okay, sigma, that's 1 over a length to the fourth. Times less, so it's an energy. It's an energy per unit area of that surface. That's all it is. Okay. And if I wanted to balance that against line tension, the line tension in terms of energy per unit area is tau q, where tau is a line, whatever the line tension is. And if you just balance those two together to find the optimum, this is just the Rayleigh calculation. Again, you get that the optimum size of these patches, of course, it scales with the Gouy-Chapman length, because that's the characteristic length of the problem. You see that in here, which is only a few angstroms. it's multiplied by the square root instead of a third root, because there's only two dimensions instead of three dimensions, of the Biram length times the line tension in units of KT, okay, times some numerical factors. If you put in numbers here, you get nanometers. Okay. So already you see, I mean, you know, because line tensions are always KT divided by a surfactant size. So if you put in those numbers, you get nanometer size patches. So already you see this is starting to look not so bad. Of course, this has nothing to do with the experiments, because all the experiments are done against a solution that has ion X-ray. So the whole issue, just like what Marcus did for these polyelectrolytes, is what the counter ion is doing. Now qualitative, okay, so what the salt does. So that's the issue. Oh, it's okay. So that's a trickier part of the problem. You know, it's not trivial to solve that problem, that electrostatic problems with salt, because then I have all the same thing of Poisson Boltzmann. I got to know where the charges go, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. But qualitatively, what happens is clear. The salt clearly screens these fields even more. Eventually, instead of falling off of z to the minus qz, it falls off of z to the minus kappa z, where kappa is the Debye length associated with the salt. So if it screens it even more, it's going to lower this energy. If this energy is smaller, that means the patches get bigger, because there's less electrostatic energy making it explode. So the sign is clear. As soon as I start adding salt, these patches, which are now of this size, will get bigger. And the question is how? Yeah, Paco.
Actually, we did this calculation. We had it out last year. And actually, if I need to end a little bit, what we found is that we have a really sharp transition. The when we introduce the screening, we actually keep the size of the layer almost fixed, and then boom, goes into macrophase segregation. That's our result on one layer.
Okay, it may be. So you've gone further than we have, because I don't know yet. Because we have that, because the calculation is tricky. But let me tell you what we've done, and then you'll see. So I don't argue yes or no either way about that. Okay. The first thing is, the other limit where it's easy to do this problem is if you have a lot of salt. If you have a lot of salt, then all you have to use is a linearized, you know, Debye-Huckel theory, which you can solve exactly, and then this electrostatic self-energy pulls up a kappa is a standard Debye screening length associated with the salt. But this is only good in the limit where Q is negligible. That means there's very little Q dependence. So in this limit, when kappa, where there's so much salt that it dominates everything, then there's no Q dependence, and then the patches should be infinite. So in other words, you have complete phase segregation. Okay, so there's no doubt about that, because you have. But this is not a realistic limit, because remember, lambda for these surfaces is a few angstroms, and that means you have to have, you know, 20 molar salt or something. In other words, so much salt that the system is unstable. So that's a case you can work, but it's not so interesting. Okay. But that's consistent with what you say, Parker. The easy thing to do is to do perturbation theory in the salt. You could do perturbation theory, which you don't usually think about when you're doing these Poisson Boltzmann problems, because you have funny divergences. But here, the potential could go to zero at infinity because the surface is neutral to begin with. So you could just, there's some range where you could put in a little salt in your system and you say, well, how does that salt react to this external field? Okay, that's applied. And so it's easy to work that out, and there are two limits. It depends whether this is big or small or one. This is the easy case, and there's a correction So this is perturbation theory in the salt. CS is a concentration of salt. You have something like that. I didn't put in numbers. The important thing to recognize is that, of course, this is negative because the log, it's a log of a small number. So the energy is going down. And the change in the patch size is linear in the salt concentration. It's not constant, but maybe linear is constant for you. But that the patch size increases linearly with salt in this limit. That's easy to do. There's a harder case, and the more interesting one is when this is small. That means you have a very, like mica, like you have a very, very strongly charged surface. And this is all, by the way, in the framework of mean field theory. So mean field theory may be questionable here, but let's do it anyway. And what I could tell you, this is difficult. Even perturbation theory is difficult because talking in quantum mechanical language, you need to go to first order in the wave function. That means you have to solve a differential equation, which involves Bessel functions. You can do it. It's all doable. And I won't bother writing down the answer because it's not very interesting. But the point is, it still has the path size increasing linearly with the salt concentration. But this perturbation theory is only valid in a very small range because it has the salt concentration in some dimensionless units, which I didn't write down, has to be smaller than some non-analytic thing, e to the minus 1 over q lambda, and that's e to the minus a big number. So that means this is only good at very, quite low salt concentration. So there's a linear perturbation, but okay, you've got to see where it's valid. So the other region is what happens in between when the perturbation theory is invalid. And as Paco suggests, there may, in fact, be a phase transition, something like a first-order transition there. We don't know that yet, although so far we don't think so. Okay, but it's very tricky just to do the analysis in that region. Because you have a two-dimensional It's a second order nonlinear differential equations where the nonlinearities are very important and where the fields are varying very quickly in space. So it's very tricky to work it out. And we have some Alexei is doing some calculations based on the variational theory of Roland and Henri Roland, but it's very tricky. Let me tell you why it's tricky. Let me go back a little bit here. It's tricky. If you just look at this picture, this region here is very highly charged cationically. The white region is very highly charged anionically. That means in between here, you have very low charge. So here you have locally a very small GUI-Chapman length. Here you have locally a very small GUI-Chapman length. In this region here, if you look locally, you have a very big GUI-Chapman length. And that's what makes this region very difficult to do. Okay? So you have fields varying very dramatically in space. But it's just, and of course you can do it numerically if you want to. But that's not very interesting. We're trying to do it using variational things, and we don't have things that I don't think there's a phase transition. So I probably disagree with Paco, but we're not sure, and it may depend on parameters. Okay. So here I told you I was going to be finished. So that's a summary. I mean, this is in some sense a minor issue, but. The patches induce attractive forces. It's nothing to do with the molecular level hydrophobic interaction, which, in my view, has only to do with breaking hydrogen bonding networks. This may be true. That's a suggestion that they're stabilized with Coulomb energies. And of course, it's sort of obvious that this may be relevant to what people call rafts, whatever rafts are. I have no idea what they are. And globular proteins, a lot of other things. And for Paco, we had this question: is there a phase transition in between? So we don't know the answer, and but you know, this may be a, you know, but we think this may be a, you know, well, this may be relevant to a variety of problems on membranes with heterogeneously charged surfaces. Is no doubt. No, so we, of course, we picked on the easiest problem to do of this nature, you know. And obviously, if the surface wasn't 50-50, if it was 60-40 or 70-30, then the problem becomes more difficult. Okay, but in the same class of problems. So one can do this, these problems, if you want to. The only thing is that we're suggesting that there may be an inherent length scale that comes in that's related to the line tension. And it's clear this, by the way, this is related to earlier stuff of McConnell, but I never understand what McConnell does. So he's, I think the physics is all wrong what McConnell does, but that's okay. You like it. I think it's horrible. But anyway, but it's clearly related.